This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Not everything is climate change. A little later, we'll talk with one of the world's top disaster experts, Robert Muir Woods, about his new book, The Cure for Catastrophe, How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. But first, according to the Center for Disease Control, industrial food is the number two cause of death in the United States and in most developed countries. We'll talk about the local food revolution with a veteran in that struggle. In November 2012, Colorado startled the world by legalizing marijuana for personal use. There's another movement coming out of that state which is even more far-reaching. It's being called a revolution that literally starts at ground level. It's the local food revolution. In fact, that's the title of a new book released October 18th. Michael Brownlee is the author of The Local Food Revolution, How Humanity Will Feed Itself in Uncertain Times. 5 years ago, I interviewed Michael as a leader in the Transition Town movement in America. I think this goes even deeper, reaching right into your refrigerator, into your body, and into our troubling future. Michael, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. It's great to be with you today.
Please tell our listeners what you've been doing that led you into this call for a revolution.
Well, for the last almost 10 years, we've been primarily focused on localizing our food supply here in Colorado. You know, we came out of the relocalization movement that was originally started by Julian Darley and Post Carbon Institute, attempting to find ways that our communities could meet their most essential needs as locally as possible. And we focused on food pretty early because we realized that that's the area where we were most vulnerable because we were dependent on a global industrial food supply. And should that supply line be cut, then we would be in trouble. So we have been learning about the process of communities localizing their food supply a long way. And even though we've been at this for a good decade, and even though lots of wonderful and beautiful things have happened in the local food movement, in reality, we haven't moved the needle very far. So here in Colorado, of all of the food that we eat here, only about 1 or 2% is actually grown within the state. We import almost everything that we eat, and we export almost everything that we grow, which is sort of an outstanding example of an unsustainable economic basis.
I'd like to read out a paragraph, a powerful paragraph, from an article you wrote at localfoodshift.pub. You say we have, quote, a food system that keeps our population in control, herded into CAFOs we call cities, fed a diet laced with chemicals and drugs that keeps our people addicted and trapped, and keeps the unholy alliance ever more wealthy and ever more powerful, we are in effect being ranched. This is tyranny through food. Well, that's big. Let's unpack it a bit. I've done a program on concentrated animal feedlot operations, or CAFOs. And is that really what we've become in cities where most people live?
In effect, that's what we have become, or we are headed in that direction. By concentrating our population this way, it is the most efficient way for the unholy alliance of big ag and big food and big pharma to make us their customers. So actually, we have become almost completely dependent on this unholy alliance for our food supply. So they are in control. They dominate our food system in this country and in most parts of the world. And the reality is that the food that we are being fed, much like the food that our animals in CAFOs are being fed, it is not good for our health. It's not good for our economy either. It is only beneficial to those behind the unholy alliance who are interested only in consolidating wealth and power. So this situation has arisen fairly gradually since World War II, so that we're really not aware of it, and we have become unconscious of the reality that we are dependently addicted to this global industrial food system.
Well, like those cows in the CAFO operations or the pigs, we're getting sick. We've got a rampant diabetes. We've got people are grossly overweight. We've got all kinds of health problems. And to overcome that, we're using all kinds of things that we shouldn't be using in medicines and pharmaceuticals. So I really can see the parallel.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's true. And, of course, this creates big financial opportunity. So we have the most expensive healthcare system in the world, and many of our healthcare problems, I would say the majority of our healthcare problems these days, are food-related. We heard that the Center for Disease Control some years ago said that the number two cause of death in this country is food, second only to tobacco. Really a startling indication of how out of whack our society has become.
Now, Michael, I'm hearing more about food deserts. What are they, and how would you describe one?
So a food desert is a place where, I forget the exact distance, but it's where people cannot access grocery stores easily. I think it's, you know, within a mile or two, something like that. So there are many parts of our cities across the country that are food deserts where people do not have access even to supermarkets. They have to travel some distance by bus or car, or even worse, they go to the corner markets in those cities where only the worst kinds of food is available. So that's the more official, traditional way of looking at food deserts. But I tend to look at it somewhat differently. I feel that we all, almost all of us, live in something of a food desert, in that almost no one has access to fresh, healthy, locally grown food except the people who are relatively wealthy in that community.
So, Michael, it's great for the few who made it to a patch of dirt to start growing food, and I'm one of them, but let's face it, many of our listeners don't have that option right now. Some work at two jobs to get by, or they're students with or parents with a part-time job on top. Some have health problems, or they live in an apartment. How can the millions of people now disenfranchised from the land participate in this food revolution?
There are lots of ways that people can participate. You know, certainly we all need to be growing as much of our own food as possible. And even people who are living in high-rise apartment buildings can grow some of their own food. I mean, they can have pots on the balcony or in the kitchen window or something like that where they're growing a little bit. And while that may not amount to much in terms of the amount of food that they might produce for themselves, the experience of doing that and what that awakens in people is extremely important. What we're going to have to do is to shift the balance of power that the Unholy Alliance has over our food supply. It's simply to stop buying and eating industrially produced food. This is something that we all can do. Maybe we can't go cold turkey 100% in one day, but gradually we have to phase that stuff out of our diet and replace it with food that is grown as locally as possible, preferably by farmers and ranchers who we know or at least know enough about to feel confident that the food that they're producing for us is healthy, really is good for us. We can all get involved politically on a local level in the shaping of policy. There are many policies that need to be changed because most of the policies related to food and agriculture in this country are actually resistant to local food production. They are in support of industrial agriculture and big food. So that's something that as citizens we can all participate in. We can all vote. So those are just some of the ways that we can get involved.
And I'd toss in community gardens. You know, they're possible everywhere, Michael, even in the inner city. Vancouver started a couple right downtown, and one of them is in the poorest part of the city. They said, oh, well, that'll never work. People just rip off all the... Didn't happen. It worked out great. So nowhere's really impossible for food.
That's right. And one of the most exciting projects that we've seen in Colorado is in probably our worst food desert in the city of Denver. This is a community called Westwood. And there's a nonprofit organization that started there, I believe, 4 or 5 years ago that focused on teaching people how to grow as much of their own food as possible, how to garden. And so there are now 400 families in that community who are raising most of their own food. The community has now gathered together to actually develop their own grocery store and food hub right in the community. So this is an outstanding example of what's possible even in the most economically oppressed parts of our cities.
And I'd like to tell listeners about a new startup in British Columbia. There's a website called soilmate.com, and hundreds of thousands of people across North America are already using it to connect up with local farmers and grocery stores that sell local food. What other sort of web-based resources have you heard about, Michael?
Well, there are certainly many, but the challenge that we face is while there are lots and lots of wonderful projects, thousands across the country, most of them are small and fairly isolated. At some point, we have to shift from this kind of siloed effort towards local food to organizing together as communities to localize our food supply on a system-wide level. This is sort of the next leap that has to be taken in the local food movement so that we could get to a place where in the next couple of decades, perhaps, where we are at a 20 or 25% local food in a particular region, whereas typically right now we're at 1 or 2% across the country. The exception, of course, is the state of Vermont, where after 15 years of concerted effort there, they are at about 7% local food in the state of Vermont. But that's a very small state. You know, the whole state's population is just about the size of Denver, and they've been working at it for quite a while. So we need to learn to think systemically. We need to learn how to bring these various organizations and companies working on local food to collaborate and cooperate together so that what we're building actually is regional food sheds in which the food supply is highly localized. That's the direction that we need to be going. And to get there, it really requires communities deciding together to take on the project of food localization, setting real goals, making that a priority in their community. And I think we made a strategic error in the local food movement early on by allowing local food to be viewed primarily as a lifestyle choice for the privileged. You know, farmers markets and TSAs and farm dinners and ecotourism and upscale restaurants have all tended to reinforce this misconception. So we say that we need to now correct that error by beginning to make it very clear that primarily because of global warming, food localization is an absolutely urgent necessity everywhere. We're learning from our scientists that the impact of global warming on global food production will be quite profound. And this is fairly new information. It really hasn't gotten out for public discussion much yet, but in January, I believe, of this year, there was a major climate conference in Tucson. One of the speakers was Dr. David Battisti, who's head of the Atmospheric Sciences Department up in the University of Washington. And what Battisti is saying is that just due to the increase in temperature, that's projected by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, we will see at least a 30 to 40% reduction in crop production globally by the end of the century. And that doesn't include the related impacts besides heat. I mean, things like the increased pest pressure, things like the increasingly unstable weather and devastating weather events, and maybe most importantly, loss of soil because of erosion, because of salinization, and because of sea level rise. So when you factor in these other related impacts of global warming, it's not too unrealistic to conclude that we will see a reduction of global food production capacity by about half, even by the middle of this century, certainly long before the end of this century. So that makes this a global food emergency, and it makes it a local food emergency everywhere to the degree that we're dependent on a global industrial food system. So suddenly now we need to shift from local food being seen as a lifestyle choice to being seen as food localization being seen as the most important and most urgent social cause on the planet today. This is the shift that we need to make. And to do that, we say, is going to require a local food revolution.
You have my vote. On Radio EcoShock, we are talking with Michael Brownlee, author of The Local Food Revolution, How Humanity Will Feed Itself in Uncertain Times. And I appreciate that you put that in uncertain times. I think, Michael, we have the phenomenon of the preppers. I'm kind of a prepper. I've got food in the basement against hard times. But I realize, especially talking to you, that it's not going to work if a few individuals can feed themselves but the whole community cannot when some sort of crisis arises. And it could be an economic crisis. There are many threats to our food system right now. Would you talk about that?
Well, certainly there are. I mean, there could be disruptions along the way at any time, and there already are in certain parts of the country. Sometimes it's because of weather. Sometimes it's because of conflict or war. Sometimes it's political reasons. Sometimes it's because of breakdown in the fossil fuel system, like happened in Cuba. But our food supply is the global industrial food supply. We know that it's profoundly unsustainable, but it's increasingly unstable. And this is what people are mostly not aware of. So if we look out into the future, we can see that we're headed into a time where these kinds of disruptions will be increasingly frequent and that our food supply will dwindle. It will be radically diminished, you know, beginning in the next couple of decades, I would say. And what most people are not aware of is that we're actually entering into a new era on this planet. It's been called by many the Anthropocene. It is an era that's been brought about by the way that we've been living on the planet. And in reality, the primary factor in this has been the way that we have been feeding ourselves. So the global industrial food system now is the largest industry on the planet, the most destructive industry on the planet. It is the number one contributor to global warming. It is the single greatest cause of the sixth mass extinction of species on the planet. And now it is bringing to an end an entire geological era and diminishing the planet's ability to support life. So we are entering into, because of all of this, what you could call a new dark age. In fact, John Michael Greer just recently published a book you might have seen called Dark Age America, in which he is based upon the history of collapses of civilization in the past. He projects out what the next 500 years could look like in this country because of what we have unleashed here. So one of the really interesting things that he suggests is that when a civilization collapses, and of course many have in the past, they always do, that the population will be decreased by about 95% over the 100 to 300 years following the collapse of that civilization. So he projects that over the next 100 to 300 years that the population of North America could dwindle down to about 25 million people. And that wouldn't be because of cataclysmic events, but because of fundamental changes in the way that we live on the planet. He sees the whole global population reducing down to about 350 million people over the next, you know, up to 300 years. We're going into radically different and very challenging, difficult times ahead. And the only way that we have as a people of surviving through this time is by building local food systems that can be kind of our lifeboat through the dark ages of the Anthropocene.
Well, that's dark enough. Let's look at some of the tools that you offer to at least put that off or survive better or adapt, let's say. And one place we can look for guidance is into the past, where humans really depended on what they could grow right around them. And I'm thinking of the early American colonists, for example. They would do things like harvest rhubarb and other roots and then force them to grow in the dark winter basements by adding heat. Can we get more tips from the past?
Well, I think we can. Certainly, I'm not an expert on that, but there's a real challenge that we have right now, and that is that we just have way too many people to feed. You know, it's not that we don't have enough food, it's more that we have too many people. So we think about this here in Colorado, where we have about 5.5 million people living in this state. The population has increased dramatically. The population of our state is expected to double by 2050, which is kind of a scary thought. But if we look at what it would take to feed the people in our state with local food, we realize that it would be almost impossible to ramp up production enough to be able to do that. So it means that we would have to import a significant amount of our food still, you know, for maybe for the next few decades. But that situation is true almost everywhere. So that tells us that we are a population in overshoot. And so if we think systemically about this, I think that we will see increasingly the kind of response that we're beginning to see in some of our cities on the East Coast with controlled environment agriculture in all forms. Hydroponics, aquaponics, vertical farming, all of this, we're going to need to be doing those kinds of things because we do not have enough land available quickly enough to grow the kind of food that's going to be necessary to feed our local population. So that's a little bit different answer from what you were looking for, but I think that we have to think on larger scale increasingly in order to meet the tsunami of this global food crisis that is headed our way.
But you're not suggesting that we try and persuade big companies like Monsanto to change their ways and let go of some of their profits. You're saying we should just go around them and produce something new. Am I right about that?
Yes, you are. I think one of the things that's become clear over the years is that it is not possible to change the direction of companies like Monsanto and Bayer and Syngenta. They are very committed to the way that they are going. And trying to affect change in that environment is a losing proposition. We're much better off building an alternative parallel food system from scratch. And that's exactly what's beginning to happen in many places all over the country. It's not very visible yet because it's still in the early stages, but people are organizing everywhere to begin not just increasing production of local food, but also beginning to cobble together the early stages of infrastructure that will be necessary to get that food into the hands of the people who need it. So that's an enormous economic shift. And meanwhile, companies like Monsanto, the Big Ag and Big Food, will oppose this direction. They will try to stop this from happening. And certainly we've been seeing that happen here in Boulder County in Colorado.
I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Colorado local food guru Michael Brownlee. He's just released a comprehensive new book, The Local Food Revolution. Well, lately, Michael, the United States has been in an election fever which is drowning out almost everything else. Is this food revolution a lefty thing, or can it cross party lines?
Well, I think it is currently outside of party line. I don't think that this is political in any way. We're having right now in our political system probably the most deeply embarrassing presidential election in American history. And in this time, which is, you know, maybe our darkest hour yet, we have an opportunity to ignite something that goes beyond politics, goes beyond economics, goes beyond policy. We have an opportunity to come together as a people to reclaim our food sovereignty, and I would say even our freedom and our dignity, by beginning locally, beginning with building localized food sheds. And I feel that this will be the source of our hope for the future. This will be our lifeboat as we plunge into the dark and stormy waters of the Anthropocene.
Well, yes, Michael, you've added a spiritual meaning to this local food revolution. I'm not sure that's necessary, but tell us why you do.
Well, spiritual is a funny word. People attribute various meanings to that, but what I would say is that we're learning that food turns out to be our fundamental connection with life itself. And part of what's happened in our society is that the industrialized food that we've been eating for the last 70 years or so has been disconnecting us from nature, disconnecting us from life. And when we reconnect with that, when we rediscover our connection with the land, with the cycles of the season, reconnect with those who are involved in producing food for people in their community, then we rediscover a sense of life and aliveness that for many of us may be only an ancient memory. But this is what is, I think, most profound about the local food revolution, is that this discovery of life at a deeper level is what's driving this.
Can you pass on a couple of success stories that have stuck with you?
Oh, gosh, yes. There's one up in Fort Collins area where a young couple who began farming about 7 years ago reached a point of success that they needed to expand their farm. They have a large CSA. They're doing very well, but they wanted to farm more land and wanted to buy land, but found it was impossible, that the land prices up there in that rural-urban interface were at about $30,000 an acre. And so they pulled together a meeting of their community and told them that the kind of farming that they were doing was going to disappear unless the community rallied around them. Long story short, what happened was the community did respond. They formed a nonprofit cooperative, and together they are purchasing a sizable piece of land there that they will lease back to that couple with a 30-year lease, and that will make it possible for that kind of agriculture to continue. And of course, that model is replicable. So there are now others who are, you know, bringing their communities together to support local farming in this way. And access to land has been one of the big barriers to the growth of local food. That's Poudre Valley Community Farms, by the way. They can be found easily online. Another one is the Rocky Mountain Farmers Union here, which is an organization over 100 years old, has been helping to build infrastructure. So there have been a number of small food hubs beginning to emerge around the state. And they have brought 13 of these enterprises together to form a network of food hubs to distribute food from agricultural areas into the city, the state. So that's a very, very promising project because it is an indication of the building of real infrastructure that is essential as we move forward.
I'd like to finish off by giving a kickstart to listeners at two different stages of this process. In the first, we talked about the folks who feel landlocked and held prisoner by what they can buy at the supermarket. What are some of the first steps people can take to get out of that food jail?
That's a good question, and not an easy question. So one of the things that we would request is that people go to our new website, localfoodrevolution.net, and there they will find the Declaration for Local Food Independence. Read that, and if you feel aligned with the principles outlined there, please sign it. Join us in this revolution. I think that the first step for all of us is to become as educated as we can be about our current food system, what it's doing to us, and what this requires of us. You know, it's in a time of revolution, we are all asked to take a stand. You know, you can't be neutral in a revolution. We can't be bystanders because otherwise we are just complicit with the very difficult problems that are unfolding. So, as I mentioned before, we have to make a commitment to withdraw from eating industrial food. It doesn't mean that we can do it immediately, but we make a commitment to move in that direction. And we have to make a commitment as communities, a real vow, a covenant, that we will localize our food supply to the greatest extent possible, as quickly as possible. So, in other words, we have to quit being compliant consumers, and we have to stop being influenced by the power of marketing and propaganda by the Unholy Alliance.
Now, the second group of listeners are right with you, Michael. They're growing what they can. They plan to get more local food. But here's the problem. It takes years and years to make these big changes to the food system. How do we keep that hope fueled so we can keep on that road to real food health and security?
I think that is the very question that we are wrestling with right now. And I think the answer lies in coming together as a people. What does that look like? I don't think it means building new organizations or nonprofits or even new companies. I think it is convening community-wide conversations about these issues. You know, when we got clear here in Colorado about the impact of global warming on our food supply, we realized that there was no one in this entire region that was even discussing the possibility of building a plan for dealing with that. There is nowhere where you can go to discuss this. So we have to begin convening that kind of conversation wherever we live, even if it means only one or two people show up at the beginning. There has to be a place where people can go to begin grappling with the challenge that we are facing.
From Colorado, we've been speaking with Michael Brownlee. He's an experienced food activist. His latest book just out is The Local Food Revolution, How Humanity Will Feed Itself in Uncertain Times. And you can find out more at localfoodrevolution.net. Of course, I'll put extra links to the book and this topic in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays, at ecoshock.info. Michael, it's always good to talk with you. Come back sooner this time.
All right. Thank you very much, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Nobody needs to die in natural disasters. According to a new book, there is a science of prediction and risk management that can warn, prepare, and save millions of lives in the future. So why isn't it being applied now? We've reached an expert's expert as Chief Research Officer for the company RMS Risk Management Solutions. Robert Muir Wood tracks global disasters. He travels into the crumbled or drowned chaos afterwards and models the risk. Robert Muir Wood was a lead author of the 2007 Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Report and the 2011 IPCC Special Report on Extremes. Governments, insurance companies, and investors listen to him. Now we're going to listen, and I expect we'll hear strategies that haven't yet made it through the mainstream media. We'll talk to Robert Muir Wood about his latest book, The Cure for Catastrophe, How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. Robert, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
Well, hi. Why don't we start at the ground level and work up? Why does the media fascination with epicenters mislead people about the real nature of earthquakes?
Okay, well, this is a detail, one could say, but it's a curious feature of history that a big earthquake is caused by the breakage of a very, very large fault. A fault is simply a discontinuity, a planar feature in the outer shell of the Earth. And the bigger the earthquake, the bigger the fault that breaks to cause it. And it's now possible to get seismologists to actually tell you the overall pattern, the overall geography of the fault that breaks to cause a big earthquake. I mean, when I say a big earthquake like the earthquake off Japan in 2011, that was a magnitude 9 earthquake. It was formed by a fault that was perhaps 500 kilometers long. But the media still ask seismologists to tell them where the epicenter is. And the epicenter is simply the point where that fault started to break. And that where the fault starts to break could be at one end or the other. It sometimes is in the middle. But it's not giving you a good picture of the totality of the fault that breaks. So it's a misleading element of how we communicate around earthquakes.
Well, we are at the detail level, and we will build up to the big picture, but I did notice that in an online video, you said Californians have completely underestimated the strength and number of possible earthquakes. Can you tell us about that?
Well, the situation in California, I mean, I think that there is appreciation that this is earthquake country. There's a plate boundary running through the state, but it's been quite a while now since there was a significant earthquake in the state. We have to go back to 1994 on the Northridge earthquake north of Los Angeles. Since that time, we've been in this extraordinary quiet period, and actually more and more people have moved to California in the past two decades who have had no experience of what a big earthquake is like. And sooner or later, somewhere, either in northern or southern California, there's going to be a big earthquake, a big high magnitude 6, low magnitude 7 size earthquake, and it's going to have very significant consequences, because while there is a very good building code today, there's a lot of legacy buildings which were built before that code, and we know a lot of those are not going to do so well. We can identify which those buildings are, but it's, and we can try and retrofit some of them, but actually we can't get on top of the totality of the whole problem of what is going to happen in the next big earthquake there.
And the actual insurance in that region has dropped for earthquakes.
Yes, I mean, for homeowners, it's down to about 10% now, which is not good. It means that a lot of people, the day after the earthquake, are going to wake up to the fact that their house may be worth less than the value of the mortgage they have on it, and they may be tempted to hand it back to the bank at that point, and that'll have a cascade of consequences on the economy. We can see it's, although on some level there's very good science in California of understanding earthquakes, of the earthquake engineering too, it's actually not fully connected with how people the disaster culture in California is not anticipating what this is going to be like to a sufficient degree.
Well, good. Robert Muir Wood, you've said risk management is a task of imagination. How did imagination fail in the great Japanese tsunami of 2011?
Well, as I say, it's a failure of the imagination. One feature of as we try and understand catastrophe risk is we need to have some understanding of how big a particular event can be. I mean, that could be how intense a hurricane could be, how deep a flood could be, or for earthquakes, just how big the magnitude of the earthquake could be, because how big the magnitude also tells us how big the tsunami that an earthquake can generate if it happens under the sea in a nearshore environment. And in Japan, in the build-up to 2011, the Japanese nuclear industry had sited 14 nuclear power plants along the Pacific coast of Japan precisely because they were assured that actually it didn't suffer the largest of all earthquakes, that they simply hadn't happened there. But in fact, some geologists and historians had discovered that there had already been a giant earthquake on this margin in the 800s, so more than 1,100 years ago, and there was increasing evidence of how big it actually had been. They took this evidence to the nuclear industry in about 2008 and 2009, but they couldn't really get people to take it seriously. And then the earthquake happened in 2011, which was pretty much a repeat of the event which had happened 1,100 years before. It was accompanied by a massive tsunami, bigger than the tsunami protection walls on the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plants. And as we know, as a result, three of them suffered meltdown. And it was all highly avoidable if they had moved the generators higher up in the stations, which is estimated, if it would have only cost $10,000 or something, they could have actually ensured there was a power supply to keep the circulation in those reactors going even after the tsunami had hit.
You know, when I lived in Vancouver, Canada, my children went to a very old brick school, and that city always knows the big one is coming, but it never seems to have the budget to make schools safe. If that happens in one of the wealthy cities of the world, what hope do kids have in northern Turkey, Chile, or any other earthquake zone?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it was a great innovation that came out of California after an earthquake in 1933 in Long Beach, where the earthquake had happened an hour after schools had closed for the day, and somebody estimated that up to 5,000 children could have died if the earthquake had occurred an hour earlier. And it actually prompted some very rapid action in California to ensure that actually schools were inspected, that first of all new schools and then old schools had to be brought up to standard so they didn't fall down in earthquakes. I mean, in California it was very successful, but they weren't able to export it effectively to other states and other countries in the way they should. And there should be, I mean, I'm not sure of the situation in Vancouver today, but I mean, there should absolutely be an inspection procedure for schools. We know what it takes. We know it doesn't cost that much, and it can really save hundreds or thousands of lives.
Very important lives. Let's move on to coastal flooding. It could be a high storm surge or a tsunami from a faraway quake. Robert Muirwood, if you had to list the top three most flood-endangered cities in the world, what would they be?
The most flood-endangered cities? There are coastlines which are very prone to storm surge flooding. I might include the city of Tampa Bay in Florida, simply because, I mean, it has not experienced a big storm surge. It has a coastline which actually makes it prone to big storm surges. It requires a particular track of a hurricane to do that, but that hurricane hasn't actually happened for more than 100 years, but one day there will be a big storm surge into the city. In Bangladesh, we know we get very, very big storm surges from typhoons, cyclones actually coming into the Bay of Bengal, and they are a huge problem. They have built many evacuation centers now made out of concrete on stilts to give people somewhere to go, but that remains extremely flood-prone. I mean, another city which concerns me, again, is simply on my list because it probably doesn't appreciate the risk, is the city of Bangkok in Thailand, which knows it has a big river flooding problem, but also there's the possibility of getting a tropical cyclone tracking into the north of the Gulf of Siam and actually pushing a storm surge in front of it, in which case the city is only just above sea level and the whole city would be flooded as a result.
They did have some flooding a couple of years ago. I can't remember the exact cause, but I remember them. The factories were flooded and so on.
Yeah, they had flooding in 2011, in the fall of 2011 in Thailand. And I mean, the subtitle of my book is how we can stop manufacturing natural disasters. And this was a classic case of a manufactured natural disaster in that the government had wanted to turbocharge the economy and by getting a lot of manufacturers who needed components from each other, for example, in the car-making business, to actually sit on the same industrial site. And in order to make this policy work, which they established in the 1990s, they needed very large areas of flat land, which was previously undeveloped and cheap, and on which to build these industrial estates. And I mean, that is another definition of a floodplain. So they used the floodplain, which had not previously been built on, of the Chao Phraya River to the north of Bangkok, and developed these vast industrial estates. And then, you know, you could not be surprised when a few years later they all flooded and remained flooded for 4 to 6 weeks, causing significant disruption to a number of technologies around the world, including hard drive and auto manufacturing.
That's why I remember it. My hard drive was threatened. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Robert Muir Wood. He's traveled the world investigating and lecturing on the biggest disasters. In September, he released his new book, The Cure for Catastrophe, How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. Well, Robert, as you know, Category 3 Hurricane Nicole recently blew through Bermuda, their second in October this year. What did the government of the Bahamas do that actually increased individual preparedness for storms?
The government of the Bahamas, in terms of actually what it has done around preparedness, I mean, certainly the Bahamas knows that it's absolutely in the front line of storms, and that everybody appreciates it. Much of it is very low-lying, so people appreciate they also have a storm surge as well as a wind hazard problem there. I mean, one story from Bahamas I tell as a sort of example of tough love is that, unlike the situation in the U.S., the government is not involved in providing a backstop if insurance isn't available. And there's a what's called a canal estate, so a very, very low-lying estate of houses on the island of Grand Bahama, which is only just above sea level, and which has been flooded in storm surges so often that you can no longer get insurance there. But actually, that's encouraged some owners to start building their houses on concrete stilts, and actually then by that means they bring them back into being insurable again. So there's a little parable about one way in which adaptation to climate change may actually work is that if the government is not involved, people will take their own action in order to increase their resilience.
There's a beautiful story in your book where during the 2004 mega flood of Thailand, the Japanese professor Toshitaka Katada devised a three-line instruction for children. It was like a tsunami haiku, I think, but I hear a value for all kinds of preparedness. I'd like to read those three lines, Robert, and then get your comment on each of them. It reads, "Don't believe in preconceived ideas. Do everything you can. Take the lead in evacuation." There's a lot packed in there. Why are these memorable steps so necessary?
Well, they're memorable steps in part because they were very successful, in that to this professor who had seen the way in which people had waited for official instruction after the great earthquake followed by a tsunami in the Indian Ocean in 2004. He'd seen from that actually he'd seen what hadn't worked, and so he came back to Japan, and he then promoted in schools in a single city his ideas for how they should distrust official information, how they should take the lead. And then two or three years after he'd given the lessons, the great earthquake happened off the coast of Japan, followed by a tsunami, and the students in the schools in the city actually really did, or enough of them followed his precepts. They didn't trust the official instruction, which was that a number of these towns had tsunami walls, and the tsunami walls weren't in fact high enough, and so they were quite right not to trust them. And they took their lead in actually running up the hill. They didn't wait for the teachers to tell them what to do, and all the other children started following them. And in fact, every child who was at school that day in this city survived, and even while more than 1,000 people in this particular city died. So this was very, very successful advice. You can't just assume that official instruction is going to have completely anticipated what is happening.
Definitely, and I think the people in New Orleans couldn't wait for the government to tell them what to do, because it just didn't come.
That's correct, yeah.
So you've been in the inner circles of scientists and other experts on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Yet it seems to me you've been wary of including climate risks in your portfolio, and you complained Lord Stern misused your research. Robert, are you cautious about the risks of climate change?
I take a scientific view of it, which is, I'm always a little worried when people jump to think about the risk of climate change before, first of all, thinking about the risks of the current state of the climate, because it's not that, we have a set of extreme events already, and then there's the question how they're changing. And there clearly is evidence that some of them are changing and will change even further into the future. But I'm a little cautious at simply labeling events climate change when we know that, I discuss in the book quite a lot about all the work that goes on in what is called attribution studies today, which is to run the Earth's climate with and without the increase in greenhouse gases back to 1950 and see what is the difference between a world which we have increased greenhouse gases and one which hadn't, in terms of if you run a climate model and you see how often you get particular events, for example, big floods in a particular part of the world. Well, the original work in this area was done in big floods happening in the UK in at this time of year, and see how what is the difference in the number of times that happens between these two worlds, between a climate change world and a non-climate change world. And that does actually tell you how the probability of some event has changed. And I think that is very, very helpful, actually getting this balance of making sure we don't get accused of mislabeling things when we don't have the evidence to identify the climate change signature, which we know is there in sea level rise, in more intense rainfall events, and, for example, in a longer wildfire season.
Another of my concerns is that a series of natural disasters close enough together could bankrupt major insurance companies, and with them, perhaps the banks, pension funds, and investors tied there. Could the system go broke?
It's very unlikely. I mean, it certainly could have gone broke, and it almost went broke about 25 years ago. But actually, I mean, I work in the area of risk modeling, and these risk models are now sort of very extensively used for how the insurance world does business around risk, and there's always some remote potential for a sequence of events to happen in some way, in an unusual way. But we can really calculate the probabilities of that. And actually, from everything I've seen, the industry is pretty robust these days. I mean, one feature, if we compare the banking sector and the insurance sector. And the banking sector had its crisis in 2007, 2008, where it's discovered that the risk models they were using really were not at all reliable because they didn't capture human herd behavior. And actually, we find if we're modeling earthquakes or hurricanes, actually the physics of the Earth is a lot more stable than actually than the contagion of human behavior that we may see in how markets behave in the banking sector.
Now, your book offers a cure for catastrophe, and that's a big idea, but please take as long as you like to give us some ideas of what should be done.
Okay. Well, I use the term the cure to catastrophe. I mean, I leave it ambiguous as to whether, is there a cure? Is there a simple cure? Is this like a slogan? Is it a hope? There is much we can do. There's much which has been done, which helps us anticipate and prepare for catastrophes. I mean, the first component is simply education. Is actually, we have a lot of good scientific knowledge of where catastrophes have the potential to occur now. Now, we're still sometimes surprised, but actually 9 times out of 10 or 19 times out of 20, we're not so surprised. The events that happened, we had really anticipated. So we can't simply blame the fact that this was surprising in some way. And in which case, then we can plan and prepare for what is likely to happen. I mean, we know a range of earthquakes which can happen around San Francisco. We know the range of hurricanes that could impact different Caribbean islands. We have this information, and we should be focused on taking the action to ensure that the buildings are able to withstand that particular level of ground shaking or wind speed or flooding, and that people are prepared, that they are informed. The culture of disasters is sufficient to let them know that they are at risk and tell them what they need to do. And we can move to a situation. I mean, I mentioned a couple of places. I mentioned Holland around its treatment of flood risk. I mean, it really has got on top of it. It's owned by everyone. It's not just done by technocrats. It's sort of owned by the population. I think that Chile in earthquakes is getting closer and closer to the day when you can have a big earthquake and actually the casualties will be measured in tens of people rather than hundreds or thousands. So we can point at examples where countries or cultures are really getting on top of being able to ride out these events when they happen. And you know, and it's not too far-fetched for there to be situations where we have a really big hurricane, a really big earthquake, and actually the consequences are fairly minimal. I mean, that won't be everywhere, but some places are moving towards that goal.
Well, we won't have time to cover much about volcanoes, which is in your book, but there haven't been many in the news lately, but that's another mistake, isn't it?
Well, for volcanoes, I describe the great challenge of volcanoes. Big eruptions are rare. I mean, at a single volcano, big eruptions may happen hundreds of years apart, so that everybody who's given the job of managing the information around a volcanic eruption is likely to be a complete novice. I mean, it's likely to be the first time they have done it. And actually, the politicians will be watching this person intently because there are many, many ways in which they can get it wrong. I mean, they can either get people to evacuate too early or too late, and they can get people to evacuate too near the volcano, and the volcanic eruption can be bigger than they anticipated, and they can get people to evacuate for too long, and so the economy can't start getting going again. So it's a huge challenge, the responsibility of being, if you like, the volcano eruption manager. And actually, we have not got a solution to that. I mean, it would be almost better if there was an international agency which was able to move in and provide this capability, but then that would be a problem with local politicians. So, yeah, I mean, we haven't seen a big eruption near a city since 1991 or something in Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines, and you know, sooner or later there will be another such threatening volcano, and the question is, are we prepared?
Well, we did run out of time before we got to fires, and that's ironic because half the countryside around me burned down last year. We had fire refugees arrive in our tiny village with absolutely nothing, so I'm personally familiar with that risk. Listeners, I've had time to read Robert Muir Wood's new book, The Cure for Catastrophe, How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. It wasn't a chore because this stuff fascinates me, and Robert does a great job of keeping us there in the scene while we learn from him. He's the Chief Research Officer for RMS Risk Management Solutions. He has a PhD in Earth Sciences from Cambridge University. He's been a lead author in two important reports by the IPCC, the author of 6 books, published over 150 scientific papers. He advises on high levels of business and government on large-scale disasters. I'll put links to Robert, his book, and some videos in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Check it out. Robert, thank you so much for sharing your time with us. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock, and thank you for caring about our world. Here is a song I'm working on called Holy Nature, as in Holy Committed.
Yes, I say it. Holy nature, give us life. Holy nature, keep on track. Holy nature, can't take it back. In the rolling thunder, in the heavy rain, in the grasp of tides, in the restless heat, break the silence, break the calm. Rescue, rescue. say, Mother Nature gives our days. Well, Mother Nature starts our hearts. Holy Nature never part. Holy Nature never part.